Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. On this Gearing Up show, we're joined by Matthew Carter, the man who accidentally became the boss of an F1 team. Well, there's a bit more to it than that. For the man that comes from the finance world, ending up overseeing the running of the Lotus Renault F1 team. He's a proven investor and businessman who has turned around struggling companies and made them millions. He's here to tell us just how he did it for the F1 team and the mountain he had to climb whilst doing it.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Motormouth podcast and the very latest in our Gearing Up series, where we shine a light on those within motorsport we think should have your attention. Before I introduce today's guest, however, I have to head over, as always, to Essex, which according to the Essex Herald is not only the UK's wealthiest county, but would qualify as the world's 53rd largest economy. Forbes magazine has also stated that the county's tax revenue alone would be sufficient to pay off the national debts of several emerging economies. However, the economic state of Essex is not what's important today. Today, it is far more important that I introduce the effervescent, charming and vibrant ray of sunshine, Mr. Harry Benjamin. How are you?
Thank you, Mr. Tim Sylvie. Wow. You know what? I think you should actually go and create your own spin-off podcast just talking about Essex, because I've lived here 23 years. You know way more than me.
It's a fascinating county, you know. There's a lot going on. Essex has got a lot going for it.
I didn't even know we had an Essex Herald. That's new to me. I knew about West Essex Life, but I didn't know about the Essex Herald. Anyway, regardless of that, I am doing well, thank you. Just sort of getting on with life as much as you can, really, in this new... Everyone keeps saying new normal, and I hate that. I don't like it. I want to get back to the old normal. I don't like this new normal. I don't know if I'm doing things right or wrong, and when I do things, it feels like I shouldn't be doing them. It's all very confusing.
I know, it's getting boring now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Shall I introduce today's guest?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we've had a few interesting characters in our Gearing Up series to date, and today has got to be one of the best. Matthew Carter is a name that most F1 fans will remember. He was the chief executive of the Lotus F1 team after the departure of Eric Boullier to McLaren. He was right at the centre of the team's ups and downs between 2013 and 2016, after Bridgehouse Capital's owner bought a stake in the team before eventually overseeing the sale of it to Renault. Let's bring in the man himself, Matthew Carter. Welcome to this Gearing Up edition of the Motormouth podcast.
Hi, how are you two?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, not too bad. Matthew, you're in Canada at the moment, aren't you? So what's life like out there, and what's it been like this year, really, this nightmare of a year?
Yeah, no, I live in Montreal, and it's been strange. It's been strange here as there. I don't think the lockdown was quite as strictly enforced here. It was very much advised only to go out for certain things. But I guess it's the same. It's very similar all over the world. It's certainly strange times. And for someone who's used to traveling and boarding so many flights, it brings you down to earth slightly.
Well, take us back though to your early life. That's what we like to do in these gearing up episodes, especially with people that fans and particularly motorsport fans. You might not necessarily know that much about you just yet, but you've had such a prominent role within motorsport and within Formula One. But before we get to that, let's take it back to sort of the start and early life. You know, what was home life? Did you grow up in the UK? And you know, what were there signs early on of what was to come?
Short answer is no, there weren't. I grew up in Cheshire. Parents, brother and sister. I then followed the usual path, went to university in Bradford, and studied management consultancy, and then sort of drifted off down my own path of I actually went off and worked for myself, and I was buying and selling companies myself from pretty much as soon as I came out of university.
How does one go about buying a company straight out of uni? I mean, I know you've got a bit of grounding with you know, the bits and pieces you'll learn at university, but then to take that into practice and actually go out and buy a business for the first time, how on earth do you do that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I actually did a couple of placements when I was at university. So there were 2 6-month placements involved within the course. And on one of those, I got a good grounding of my first introduction to insolvency practitioners and the way that overdrafts work and the way that directors' guarantees can get called into play by banks, et cetera, et cetera. So when I left, I maintained contact with an insolvency practitioner, and he actually put me in touch with a guy who was looking to sell his company fairly cheap, just because he wanted out, because he'd given some directors' guarantees, and he didn't really understand the ways of the world and how a limited company works in the UK. And so I went in there fairly cheap, turned the company around, made myself some money, and then used that money to continue doing that. And I worked for myself maybe 5 or 6 years before coming into contact with a guy called Andy Ruin, who, as you rightly said at the top of the show there, he runs a company, or ran a company, called Bridgehouse Capital. And he effectively asked me to go and work for him to do what I was doing, but in essence, using his bigger pot of cash than mine.
So you would effectively go out and look for different opportunities within different businesses in certain sectors, and then try and turn them around for a profit?
Exactly. So that's exactly what I was doing. When I joined Andy at Bridgehouse, it was more... So Bridgehouse is a venture capital firm, but it's privately owned, so it's his cash, essentially. And he would go out and often would buy a portfolio of companies, and within that portfolio, there'd be one black sheep, if you like, or one that was that needed a little bit more work. And I was his kind of go-to to go into that company and restructure it, sometimes liquidate assets, maybe look for somebody else to buy it out or whatever. And I did that for him for, crikey, 10, 12 years on and off. And during that time, so at this point, no interest whatsoever in motorsports, to be perfectly honest. My father worked for Imperial Tobacco, so I had a picture of Senna in his Black Lotus, bizarrely, how things moved on, on my wall when I was a kid. But that was just because my father worked for the JPS tobacco company. So I worked for Andy for a number of years, and he and one of his partners, a guy called Gerard Lopez, are both very keen, I guess you would call them gentleman drivers, but maybe a little bit more than that. So they did some sort of 12-hour endurance races and things like that. And at some point, it was after Renault had their slight mishap in Singapore, where Nelson Piquet Jr. was asked to deliberately crash.
I remember that so well, because I was there working with Renault, and I was working with ING Bank, who at the time were the very expensive title sponsor of the team. And I was there in my lovely white trousers and my orange ING polo shirt, and we were there watching this unbelievable crash unfold. So was that your first sort of introduction? This is where it all started to happen?
No, so not at all. So basically what happened, so at this stage, I'm still working for Bridgehouse on crikey logistics companies and baby food and fruit juice and hotels and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And so So when the crash happened, obviously Renault was slightly disgraced, or Flavio certainly was, and, yes, and some of the senior members of the team. So Renault effectively wanted out of F1, or certainly from the team side. They were going to continue to supply engines, but they wanted to be out of the team side. Gerard, in some way, shape, or form, had formed some sort of a working relationship, or at least a knowledgeable relationship with Bernie. And Bernie advised Renault that there could potentially be a fit there. So I think 2009, 2010, they walked in and picked up the team. Well, we can refer to it as Team Enstone, if you like. So it was Renault at the time. They walked in there and they picked it up for a reasonably decent price, and then set about trying to turn the thing around. So they did a deal with Lotus Cars to be their title sponsor. So it was never a Lotus, it was never anything to do with Lotus. Lotus were simply a sponsor of the team. So they did a deal with Lotus. They decided to go for the black and gold livery, signed, moved things on. And then towards the end of 2012, 2013, they had Kimi and Roman, and they were winning races. They were performing very, very well. What was going on in the background, which is, I guess, is kind of a little bit more of my forte, was that they were running on Renault money without actually having Renault money, if you like. So all the team were still continuing to do everything that they'd always done in the past. And effectively, we get to the end of the 2013 season, or drawing towards the end of the 2013 season. So this was the last season before the hybrid engines. Renault was probably the best engine. It was powering the Red Bulls, and had powered the Red Bulls to their multiple world championships. And Lotus were pretty much considered to be the second quickest car on the grid. As I said, Kimi was winning races and everything was going reasonably well. But behind the scenes, they were losing a fortune. They were losing money hand over fist. And the two
actually,
owners,
just to cut in there on that, I heard a rumor, and I don't know if this is true or not, about Kimi and his contract, especially early on, or I'm not sure if it was his first or second year, but something to do with he got an extra however many thousand for every point he scored. And obviously he finished, what, second or no, third in the championship at one point. Well, is that true?
It's exactly what happened, yeah.
Oh, God.
So Kimi, forward 6 months or so, and I'm having to deal with Kimi and his manager, a guy called Steve Robertson, because they had a winding up petition for the team. So I was trying to negotiate, and I negotiated. He was owed 16 million at the time.
Oh my God.
And I negotiated that we would pay them. We paid them 9 in a full and final settlement. And Kimi never, ever spoke to me since then. He would deliberately look the other way in the paddock, and he would tell people that me personally, owed him 7 million euros or whatever, however much it worked out to. But yeah, so what Kimi actually did, so Kimi was rallying at the time. He was sort of thinking of coming back into racing, and he was talking to a few teams, and Gerard agreed a deal with him whereby he would get a basic salary, and then he was getting 50,000 euros per point as a bonus.
Wow.
And the first race, so 2012, the first race he won in Australia, so that's 25 points, so it was half a million.
Oh my God.
The second race he came second, getting 18 points. So by the end of that first month, he was owed almost 1 million euros. And effectively, that's where we got to. So when we get towards the end of 2013, the team are struggling financially, and it's very public. They failed to meet staff salaries a couple of times. They didn't pay Kimi. And he went very public with that, if you remember. He did a press conference where he said he hadn't been paid a euro for the season. Mm-hmm. And then with about 3 races to go, with the team sitting firmly in second in the championship behind Red Bull, he developed a mysterious back problem, if you remember, and disappeared off, said he couldn't race the last 3 races of the season, and went and signed a contract with Ferrari, who at that time were third in the world championship. And consequently overtook Lotus to get a huge amount more championship money for the next season. So Kimi walked away. There's a few twists and turns in this 2013 season already. They signed a deal, or the guys at Lotus agreed a deal to get Nico Hülkenberg to come in and race the final 2 races of the season. Hülkenberg was driving at Sauber at the time. And the reason they could pull him from Sauber was because he also hadn't been paid. So Sauber were in breach of his contract. So Lotus were going to bring Hülkenberg over, and he was going to race the last 2 seasons. He came to Enstone, he signed a pre-agreement, he had a seat fit. And then Sauber, who were running Ferrari engines at the time, mysteriously managed to find the money. Oh. Who knows where?
Oh, where
obviously,
did that
come he was
from?
Italian, but they managed to find the money to pay his contract up. So therefore, they were no longer in breach, and he couldn't come and race.
Oh my God! You've got to love the politics of Formula One. No other sport does
it.
I'm
not
this.
Even involved yet. This is all prior to me becoming involved. He ran around like lunatics, and they managed to get Heikki Kovalainen to come in and do those last two races, if you remember. And it was all a bit of a disaster. And he'd been out of the sport for a while. And whilst he was fairly quick, he could be fairly quick. He was very inconsistent.
Yeah.
And they ended up dropping from second in the championship down to fourth, which, as I'm sure you're aware, has huge consequences on the money you get from FOM the following year. And the guys called me in and they said, look, you know, you go and look at these businesses that are struggling. Well, this one here is hemorrhaging cash. Can you go and look at it? So I remember having the conversation. I said to them, look, I don't know anything about Formula One, but I'll go in there and I'll treat it like a business. So, I mean, it's got an accounts department, it's got a manufacturing department, it's got an HR department, it's got I'll treat it like I would any other business and we'll see where we go. So I go in there so it was just after the season had finished, so it must have been November 2013, and prepared my normal report for them to say, this is what I think you should do, which included reducing the staff from, at the time it was 600, they had 600 employees. So it was reducing the staff down to 500 and a few cuts and things that we could do along the way, and presented it to them. And they said, okay, we like the idea of this. We're going to sack the CEO. He was a guy called Patrick Louis at the time. We're going to sack the CEO tomorrow. We'd like you to take over as CEO. I initially said no, because at the time I was working for Bridge House, and I just enjoyed working for Bridge House. I never worked for the companies themselves. I was kind of a consultant dipping in, dipping out. And they said, look, this is a bigger deal. So we want you there full time. So I initially said no. Then one of them, this was in the boardroom at Enstone, and one of them pulled me outside and said, you realize what you're saying here? You know, we're offering you the role of CEO of an F1 team. So I said, yeah, I agree. So I go back in and I say, yeah, okay, I'll do it. But, you know, I don't know anything about the racing side. So they said, that's fine. We've got Eric Boulier is our team principal. He'll run the race side. You run the business side. So I said, okay, on those conditions, I'm fine to do that. So very, very early on, within the first, maybe the first week, I got all the staff together in the race bays in Enstone. So all 600 staff, they put me on a plinth so that they could see me. I basically said to them, a speech which I've done at a lot of companies down the line, but, to say, look, you know, you're all aware that we're in difficulty. You know, we're here to help. I'm here to help. I'm here to make sure the business succeeds and we succeed as a company and a team. But we're going to have to make some cuts. So if any of you are nearing retirement age, if any of you have got potential job offers elsewhere or whatever, then, my door's open. Come see me and we'll start going through this painful process. But, you know, once that's done, then we can move forward. So I started off down that route. So we're probably 10 days into this by now. And Eric comes into my office and says that he's accepted the job at McLaren and explains it to me as a football player going to Manchester United. It was his dream job and he couldn't turn it down. And whilst he was looking forward to working with me, you know, he had to take it. So I said, okay. So he left. So I only worked with Eric for, as I say, 10 days, 11 days. So he disappeared and I picked the phone up to the two owners and said, we've got a slight problem. Eric's left. So they said, yeah, okay, we're going to send you over a list of potential replacements. So they sent this list of replacements over and it was, you know, the usual suspects you can imagine. And let's not go into details, but the wages that they were requiring was astronomical. And I had literally just come out of a meeting with a guy who was paid 25 grand a year and, you know, I was having to lay him off. So I ring back the owners and I say, look, you know, I can't do this. It doesn't sit well with me. And I remember they basically said, well, you need to deal with it. So I called the senior management in. There's a guy who's still at Renault called Alan Permain, who is effectively, I think his title is sporting director. He's the one that we had the conversation with Kimi when Kimi told him to, you know, leave me alone. I know what I'm doing.
Alan.
So with all the senior management sit around and Alan Permain turns on to me and he says, look, I've pretty much got us covered at the races, you know, from a sporting side, you know, from a strategy side, from a pit stops, from, you know, dealing with the FIA, dealing with all the technical regulations. I got that covered. So I said, okay, so what does Eric do? So he said, well, we need someone there that can deal with the media because I haven't got time. someone that can deal with the sponsors, and more importantly not than anything else, is available to go to the, his exact words, the stupid meetings that Bernie calls during the race weekend that would take someone who's working on the, you know, on track, would take them away from proceedings for an hour or so. So they all sat around the table and they basically pointed at me and they said, you can do it. I was like, well, hang on. They were like, you know, we've not known you long, but obviously, you know, you can hold court in front of sponsors. We're sure you can be, you know, articulate enough in front of the FIA and Bernie. So why don't you do it? So I called back the owners and I said, this is our plan. And they said, okay, we'll see how you go. So
that is scope creep of the most horrible kind. You know, you sign up to be a CEO, which is one thing, but taking on the effectively the team principal part opens up a whole different ball game. I mean, did you have any idea what was to come in terms of media attention? You know, I was watching a YouTube video with you being interviewed in the pit lane by Coulthard and Susie Perry. Susie Perry. Susie Perry?
Well, back in the BBC days.
Susie Perry. And you're being interviewed by them and they're probing, you know, about finances and all sorts of things. And you're sort of there trying to bat them off. I'm thinking, you know, is he media trained? Was he expecting this? How were you feeling on the inside, honestly, like when you were going through all that sort of stuff?
The business side of it, no problem at all. I'd run businesses that were bigger and smaller and whatever. That was fine. It was the, as you say, it's the public notion of it all. You know, the fact that you are... If you run it backwards a little bit and you take it as a company, you're a company competing against nine other companies doing the same thing. But not only that, you're very publicly graded every 2 weeks on how you're getting on. You know, there's nowhere to hide. It's not, you know, you can't just have a few off weeks or off months or whatever and come up with a new product. It's very, very public. So pressure-wise, it was huge. Within 2-3 weeks, I was at... So, they still have it now. There's a strategy group in Formula One, which is the top six teams, the FIA and FOM. So within 2-2.5 weeks, I was at Biggin Hill, sitting around this huge table with Bernie at one end, John Todd at the other, with Christian and Toto and Stefano at the time, Claire. Because it's the top six teams, or it's the top five teams, and then Williams at the time.
Yeah,
bizarrely.
Are they looking at you like, who is this guy with no F1 experience? What's he doing here?
Yeah. But I think they'd kind of Lotus at the time were kind of seen a bit like that. You know, they'd punched above their weight in 2013, and Bernie pulled me to one side very early on, and we had a conversation, and he obviously got on reasonably well with me. He was happy that there was someone running the team that was going to... See, Bernie's a very interesting character, and I spoke to him yesterday, actually. He doesn't like anything to tarnish Formula One in any way, shape, or form, or his view of what he's built up in Formula One. So rumours of a team that's not paying wages, not paying drivers, it just grates on him. So, you know, he was pleased that someone had come in that was hopefully going to stop all those horrible rumours.
Do you think your sort of almost lack of F1 knowledge from the sporting side of things helped you in a way for dealing with what was to come, sort of almost a sort of a blissful ignorance?
Well, so what happened? So I do a few meetings. We do the testing at Jerez, which was an absolute disaster. So if you remember, this was the start of hybrid engines. We had the Renault. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
So,
was your first car the one with the sort of twin, the Tusk nose?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which was sold to me in our confidential meetings as this was genius. This was going to be the thing that was going to set us aside. This was going to be our double diffuser. This was going to take us forward. And when we got to the first test and nobody else had it, honestly, the guys in the technical department were like, yes, nobody else has picked up
world
on this.
Champions.
We need to really drive forward at the start of the season before everyone else picks up on it. But yeah, so we did testing at Jerez, but the Renault engine was just shocking. You know, if you remember, even in the Red Bull, Vettel we couldn't do a lap. We couldn't get the engine to complete more than a lap. It was horrible. And then we go to, so my first ever race that I attended, first ever F1 race, is Melbourne 2014, and I'm sitting on the pit wall. I'm on the grid before the start. I'm on the pit wall. That's my first experience. So we go, and with some optimism, I don't know if you know that. Well, I'm sure you do, Tim. I'm not sure if you do, Harry. But the paddock is set up in the order that you finished, and the garages are set up in the order that you finished the season before in the championship. So Mercedes is always either first or last, depending on the layout of the circuit. So the idea is it gives them a little bit of an advantage when it comes to pit stops. But it also, so your hospitality sits behind the garage in the paddock, so you're directly lined up. So the team were absolutely ecstatic because we'd finished fourth and we were ahead of McLaren. So every morning, Ron Dennis had to walk past our hospitality. So everyone's sitting outside having their coffee and Ron's walking past. And the team loved that. They loved the fact that we were up there. So we go to Australia, and bear in mind, we'd won it 2 years before. We'd been a very, very successful car. We qualified 21st and 22nd.
Yeah, it didn't go great.
22 cars. I'm there with the guys from Microsoft, who I was trying to convince to increase their sponsorship in the team. And I was at dinner on the Saturday evening with the guys from Microsoft. And I was obviously fairly depressed about the whole situation. And I'm talking to this guy from Microsoft, a guy called Christian. And he says, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, normally, if it was a normal business, you know, I'd get in early tomorrow. I'd like try and really pump up the guys. I'd try and really gee them up and do some sort of a rousing speech. And he said, well, do that. Do what you would normally do. And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. So I'm texting with the guys who were picking me up in the morning, and they were due to pick me up at 10:30, let's say, and take me to the circuit. And he says, look, I'm going in early. I've got a group of VIPs. We're going in on a minibus. We're leaving the hotel at 9. So I said, okay, I'll jump on with you. So his VIPs loved it because they had a team principal sitting on the front of the minibus. So they take me into the circuit. Not only do they drop me at the front entrance as opposed to the paddock entrance, so they drop me there. I have no idea where I am. I've never been to this before. Every time I've been into that circuit, I've been with someone else who's showing me around. So they drop me off at the front entrance. So I try and get the attention with 100,000 fans or more in full team kit, full, you know, black and gold team kit with my pass on the net. So I try and find someone. I find a steward eventually, and she comes over and she looks at my pass, and it obviously says grid, pit wall, paddock on it. And she says, what are you doing here? I said, it's a long story. Can you just get me to the paddock? So she puts me in a little golf buggy, and I was completely at the other side of the circuit. So she drives me on this golf buggy all the way through to the paddock, get to the paddock, the entrance to the paddock. Paddock's completely empty. There's nobody in there at all. This is strange. So, you know, you beep into the paddock. So yeah. Beep, beep. So I beep in, walk into the paddock. There's nobody in the paddock at all. Whole place is deserted. So I walk down to our hospitality. I go in, see the waitress. She brings me a cup of coffee out. I'm sitting there on the front. I'm on my phone, sort of texting people to find out where they are. And there's a guy who used to work for Bernie called Pasquale, who is like the, yeah, Tim's nodding. He's
yeah,
like the
I've dealt with
police,
Pasquale.
The enforcer of all rules and regulations, and also Bernie's right-hand man to a large extent. And he comes over to me, and he walks up and he says, oh, it's Matthew, isn't it? And I said, yeah. He said, oh, we haven't met you. I'm Pasquale. Nice to meet you. I said, yeah, good to meet you. And he said, it's your first race, isn't it? And I said, yeah. And he said, you realise that you've just broken the curfew for your team?
Oh, God.
I said, what? And he said, there's a curfew. You're not supposed to, you know, no one from the teams are supposed to come into the paddock before a certain time. That's why it's empty. I was like, okay, what does that mean? And he said, well, you're allowed to break it. I think it's twice. And then you start to get penalty points and positions docked.
This is amazing.
So my rousing idea of going in and giving the team a huge kick up the backside turned into an absolute disaster. And good news, I mean, it is a good story, you know, and it's 100% true. But the good news is we had actually already broken the curfew because the guys had been in the garage the night before anyway, but I didn't know that.
You must have felt like the new boy at school or something. Like,
for sure.
You know, with all that business experience behind you, you must have felt like, this is not fun. I'm not enjoying this.
It gets worse. This is my first race. Okay, this is the first race, and I'm on the pit wall, and I'm literally sitting there. I've got my microphone up. So you see them with their microphones around the headphones. I've got it up in the air. I have no intention of speaking to anyone. I'm just sitting there listening to everything. Exactly. Listening to what's going on to try and see where we are. And something happened to Roman's car during the race. And we were running around in, I don't know, 14th or 15th or something like that. And there's eight guys sit on at the time at the pit wall. There was eight guys sitting along, and I was at the far right hand side. And Alan Permain, who I was talking to you about before, who's the sporting director, is at the far left hand side. So we're getting towards the end of the race, and I suddenly hear through my microphones, "What do you think, Matthew?" And I'm, he must be talking to somebody else. He's obviously not talking to me. And then I sort of look, lean back. I remember it like it was yesterday. I lean back. So I've got these seven other guys' backs. I lean back and he leans back and he points to the microphone. And he's, they've already told me on the panel in front, there's a button I can press to speak to people. So I put the microphone down and press the button. And he says, what do you think? We need to decide whether or not to retire Roman to protect his engine and his gearbox. So I said, okay, what's the issue? So he said, well, he's running around in whatever it was, 14th. Ideally, we'd like to retire him to protect the engine components. But, you know, if there's an accident in front, if there's, you know, if something happens, if a few other people retire, because it was a war of attrition that first year of hybrid. If something happens, you know, we could get in the points and that could be huge for us this year. So I was like, shit. So I said, okay, what do you think? We think we should retire.
Okay.
I concur.
Sounds like so a good idea. Yeah.
We retired the car and yeah, it was fine. Nothing happened ahead and he wouldn't have got any points. But I go over to Alan afterwards and I was like, what the hell was that all about? What are you doing putting me on the spot? And he said, look, he said, the way that we have things set up at the moment is that we will defer to the most senior person on the pit wall when it comes to something like a retirement, because it doesn't look good for sponsors. It doesn't look good for anything. So we will always defer. If you want to change that, then so be it. But so I was like, no, okay, we'll keep it. But I remember leaving Melbourne and I spent the whole flight back and probably the next 2-3 weeks just immersing myself in F1, everything that I could. I went to every technical meeting that the team were having, meetings where they were like, well, why are you here? And we're talking about a front wing adjustment that we needed to do. And I was like, yeah, I want to come to everything. So I just immersed myself in everything to the extent that, you know, however long it was, 2 years later or a year and a half later, I was fairly knowledgeable on everything that was going in and could make fairly reasonable calls strategically or whatever. But yeah, that first race was scary.
Do you think you then turned the tide a bit? You know, because I know you're still in touch with people like Toto and others who are still in the sport. After that initial kind of, who is this guy? Who does he think he is coming in, thinking he can run an F1 team? Do you think there came a sort of point where everyone was like, okay, fair dues, you know, he's done his homework, he's learning, he gets it?
I think so, yeah. I think they also, I mean, F1 teams are very, very different these days, as you know, team principal as it used to be is no longer team principal. You know, you have a CEO, you have a business person. They're such big organizations that you need someone that understands the business side as well as the sporting side or whatever, or even can just focus on the business side. So, yeah, I mean, it was hard those first few months or whatever, but, you know, again, it's such a traveling circus. You see these people every 2 weeks. You know, I did, you know, the team principal's press conference, you know, and you're 10 minutes before and 10 minutes after, you know, they realize that you're not a bumbling idiot that doesn't know what you're talking about completely, you know, that you're reasonably switched on and, you know, you're fairly, I like to think, a fairly pleasant guy that they could come and have a coffee with and have a chat.
But even then, did you, when you were doing those press conferences, did you ever get a question from, I don't know, you know, someone technical from Autosport that sort of put you on the spot and you thought, I just don't know the answer to that question?
Well, I had a bit of media training. I think all the team principals do. And you're very much told to stick to the narrative. And, you know, if someone asks you something that doesn't fit with what you're trying to get across, you just, you know, you, as you said, when I was being interviewed by David Coulthard, you know, you just circumnavigate slightly. You play a very straight bat. I did get caught off guard in the Silverstone presser by a guy from the Times, but that was because I said that they were being very negative in the stories that they wrote. So at the time, again, it's all very public, but our financial, we solved our financial issues, if you like. So 2013, the team lost 64 million sterling on just over 120 turnover. So that gives you an idea of the wastage that was going on there.
Yeah.
2014, we lost about 5 million, just over. So I took it from 64 to 5. 2015, we broke even. 2016, we sold back to Renault. So there was, the path was exactly what I was supposed to do. But when Renault came in to talk to us, they spent probably 6 months doing their due diligence. At some point during that process, the two owners turned around and said, well, we're not going to continue to fund this. You know, if Renault want to buy it, then they need to fund it. So we got to this impasse where Renault were very, very slow in forwarding funds and lots of suppliers were getting upset, and we had some crazy stories in 2015 of arriving in Hungary and not having any tires because I hadn't paid Pirelli. We arrived in Mexico and I couldn't afford to, I could either afford to pay the tires or the hospitality, so I didn't pay the hospitality. So the journalists had, there was lots of very, very public pictures of our hospitality with almost like cordoned off tape across it, and the mechanics sitting at the back of the garage eating packs of crisps. So we went through this whole period of kind of getting the ship righted, then the sale process to Renault, which was tedious and long at the time. But during all of it, I think the other team principals were great. Honestly, I've got a lot of time for all of them. I think they're well, except Ferrari, never had any. As soon as Stefano left, zero contact. You know, they just didn't. They don't seem to mingle in the same.
Yeah.
I mean, Christian and Toto absolutely fine, but the Ferrari team principals never.
Well, Ferrari have got their own problems to solve at the moment, haven't they? But what, looking back at your time as effectively team principal, what was your main highlight, and then the absolute worst point where you thought, oh my God, was there a point where you just wanted to chuck in the towel?
The absolute low light was probably the qualifying in Australia. There was a few times when, so as you remember at the time, we took Pasta as well.
Oh yes, Pasta Maldonado. Of course. Good old Pasta.
And we took him, you know, let's be honest about it. We took him because he brought a big chunk of cash with him. And we took him from, this again, prior to my time, but they spent an awful lot of time convincing him to come from Williams to Lotus. Because Williams were terrible and Lotus were great. So at the time, Williams had finished really, really dismally in 2013, and Lotus had been, as we previously said, second fastest. Fast forward to 2014, Williams have got a Mercedes engine, we've got a Renault engine, and, you know, I've got Pasteur and his family and all these people from Venezuela constantly coming to the races and watching him qualify 20th, 21st, 22nd, watching Williams competing for podiums. But that was pretty dismal. My highlight, without a shadow of a doubt, was Spa 2015. Roman got a podium.
Yeah.
And I would still argue that in a fairly undramatic race, so it wasn't as if it was rain affected. It wasn't as if there was anything. I mean, apart from Vettel's tire exploding on the penultimate lap, but it was a fairly normal dry Spa, and we got a podium.
You'd earned
on a
it.
Shoestring of a budget.
Yeah.
Yeah, it must have been a great
with
feeling.
With bailiffs in the garage.
Looming.
Yeah. No, they were in the garage. So there's a weird rule about Spa and Belgium in that if you can convince a judge that you've got a genuine debt owed to you, then you can seize goods. And it happens a lot if you look back in the history books, it happens a lot in Spa that teams like Eddie Jordan's team and people like that, you'll see they often get into strife in Spa. So we had taken Charles Peake. I signed a deal with Charles Peake to be our third driver. Again, the start of 2014, genius deal. And he paid a chunk of money to be our third driver. And he paid a chunk of money to have 10 FP1 sessions. So I told the two drivers this and they went apoplectic. So Pastor literally just stomped his feet and said, you can't, it's in my contract. So I go back and look at his contract, which I hadn't signed. And it was in his contract that he had to do all the practice sessions. Roman basically said, look, and again, I'll speak candidly on here, but Roman turned around and said, look, you know, I'm the one that sets the car up. You know, if it's not for me, then we could go off in any sort of direction, because I love Pasta to pieces, but you know, if he suddenly went 0.2 quicker, was that because we'd done some changes on the car, or was it just because Pasta had not messed up a corner, or that Pasta had, you know, he'd just done something different, and he didn't know either. So it wasn't as if he could come in and give you a real, like, so Roman basically said, look, you know, we're going to compromise the setup of the car if I don't do the FP1s. But I'd taken this money from Charles. And as the season progressed, things got worse and worse. You know, obviously the nose wasn't working, as we talked about just now, and the engine was terrible. So long story short, I didn't give Charles all 10 that he'd paid for. We just couldn't do it. There was some races where we needed to have Roman in. So Charles is from a very wealthy family, and they seized on the Spa Belgium ruling. And that weekend we had bailiffs in the garage, making sure that we didn't. So the third place trophy sat in Spa in the garage for about a week, until we resolved our issues with Charles and then got all our stuff out.
I'm loving this. There's got to be a book in here somewhere, surely. There's this turbulent time.
It's the politics of F1, isn't it? It's brilliant.
There's so many questions.
There's so many. Honestly, there is definitely a book in here somewhere, but there's so many stories. So the engine moving from Renault Mercedes, I mean, that's almost a mini story all of its own. Yeah. So when I rock up and sit down at my CEO's desk at Enstone, which was Flavio's desk, and Flavio's PA was my PA. So Rosella, and she had some amazing stories some amazing hookups. She was incredible. Still is. When I sit down, on the corner of my desk is the 5-year engine agreement with Renault at 20-odd million euros a year to have the hybrid engine. And it's not been signed. The final full copy hasn't been signed by my predecessor. And it's very, very obvious that the Renault engine is terrible, shocking, the worst. So at one of the, and I just, every so often Renault would ring and say, just a formality, but you know, you haven't, can you just, you know, stick your moniker on the, well, probably not, they probably said something French, but you know, can you sign the deal? And I'd say, yeah, I've just not got around to it yet, don't worry. And there's a strong link between Renault and Enstone, obviously. I mean, they own the team, a lot of employees. If you ever go to the factory in Enstone and you go to the engine factory in Viry, it's the same furniture and the same design, the same, they're very, very intertwined. Mm. So I don't think that they ever thought there was a possibility that we weren't going to sign that agreement. So in one of the strategy group meetings, I happened to be sitting next to Toto and chatting away to him. And McLaren were going to Honda. So there's a rule in F1, again, as I'm sure you know, that the engine suppliers are only supposed to supply 4 teams. Mm. So at the time, Mercedes were supplying McLaren, Williams, themselves, and Force India. Yeah, that's right. So they supply 4 teams, and McLaren were going to Honda. Ron had made this decision that they weren't going to win anything if they weren't a manufacturer team, if you like. So Toto says to me, we've got a spare engine going for next season, 2015. So I said, okay, so that's interesting because we've not formally concluded our deal with Renault. And he said, how's that happened? And I said, it's just one of those things. So me and Toto started talking and we concocted an agreement that's what we would do. We had to keep it all very undercover because the guys had to start designing the 2015 car based around a Mercedes engine. So only certain people within Enstone even knew, because there's all different hookup pickup points and there's different engine supports, et cetera, exhausted. You know, it's all very different. So we started off down this route, and I remember speaking to the two owners, and they basically said, "Well, what are the downsides of this?" And I said, "Well, honestly, there's not many downsides other than we technically don't have an engine agreement in place." So he said, "Okay, what does that mean?" And I said, "Well, technically, Renault could not supply us an engine at a venue because the way it works in Formula One is so the engine, you never really come into contact with the engine as a team. So Renault would deliver the engine to the circuit, we'd deliver the chassis, they'd be put together at the end of the race, they'd get taken down, the engine goes one direction and the car goes the other. So it's not as if your four engines come back with you to Enstone. They're very separate.
You're out of control of it.
Exactly. So I said that there's a very, very small chance that Renault could really get the hump with what's going on here. And so the two owners, again, the two owners in Classic, I'm painting them in a bit of a bad position, but they basically said, well, you know, that's down to you. You know, it's your decision. So I said, okay. So I remember we got towards the end of the season and it became obvious. Renault obviously got wind of the fact that it was going to be very obvious. So at the time, Cyril was working for Renault. And so he'd run Caterham badly. And then he went to Renault engine department and ran that badly. Mm-hmm. And
you two are not pals then.
That's not fair. So we get, so Singapore, we're in, Singapore's a bizarre race anyway, because everyone stays on UK time.
Yeah,
so you effectively, you're having breakfast at 6 o'clock in the evening or however it works, but you're up into the very, very late hours of the night. So it's like 4 a.m., but for us it's 6 p.m. or whatever it was. And everyone's in the bar of the Ritz-Carlton in Singapore. All the teams are pretty much in there. And he comes storming over to me. Literally, we had to be pulled apart. Oh, there was someone got in between us to pull us apart because he came like within an inch of my face. effing and blinding and telling me that he was going to ruin, and who did I think I was?
Where's Netflix when you need him, eh?
I've said this to many, many people subsequently. It would have been the best episode because the Mercedes-Benz lawyer, Caroline, was sitting at another table. And he was saying, you can't do this, you can't do this. You know, I've spoken to Toto, he's not going to give you an engine. So, you know, you need to sign this contract because, you know, you're going to have no engine. You're going to ruin this. Who do you think you are? You're going to take a whole team down. This sport is, you know, going on a right rant. And I said, well, Cyril, let's go over there and talk to Caroline because the agreement's signed. It's done. You know, we have a Mercedes engine for next year. And he's like, no, you're lying. You're lying. You're lying. And yeah,
you're lying.
Literally got pulled apart by one of the guys.
Wow. And he's known for his outbursts, really, isn't he? Cyril, he's had quite a spat with Christian Horner as well, Red Bull, when they parted ways.
So I turn the team. So we get Mercedes engines. Everything is obviously much, much better. So, you know, we start to do reasonably well. I think we qualified like fifth and sixth in a couple of races. You know, we obviously got the podium in Spa. Things are going well. So finances turned round. Success of the team turned round. The two owners then start talking to people about purchasing and who steps up to buy it, but Renault. And who is dealing with the Renault negotiations.
Oh, goodness me.
You literally cannot write this kind of stuff. It's perfect.
I've got a question for you. So, I mean, we could talk all night about, you know, the stories and everything else, but I'm keen to get your opinion on a couple of things. Obviously, you, as you mentioned, you were chatting to Bernie recently. Would you take Bernie back over Liberty, or do you think Liberty are doing a good job now?
Well, I mean, there's two things. A, I'm slightly biased because I do have a lot of time for Bernie and for what he did in the sport. And B, I never worked under Liberty. So Liberty came in. So again, the reason I'm here in Montreal is that we sold the team. So Cyril comes into the negotiations. It's very clear early on that they're bringing their own senior management team in and that Cyril's going to run the team, which is fine. You know, I'd spent 2.5 years going to every single race, and when you're running the team the way that I was running it, or running the business, let's say the way I was running it, I wanted to be back in the UK for Monday morning to have meetings with all the heads of the departments, as I would do in any other business. So I'd often leave the races before they'd finished on a Sunday evening. I'd often be gone before the end of the race to get back to the UK. So I was toast by the time we sold the team. I needed some time off, and I was at that time was engaged to a girl that I'd met here in Montreal. During the 2015 season. So I was having some time off. I was trying to work out what to do, and Bernie called me, and he'd met my now wife, and he knew she was from Montreal at an event somewhere. And he called me and he said, you know, what are you up to? What are you doing? So I said, I'm taking a bit of time off. You know, I'm certainly not going to go and work for Renault. So he said, okay. He said, are you settling in the UK or in Montreal? So I said, well, we're going to settle in the UK. So he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know yet. And at the time, Ron had offered me a job, and Stephen Fitzpatrick, the guy who owned Manor, had offered me a job as well. So I was trying to decide what to do. So Bernie said, would you consider relocating to Montreal? Well, I'd love to. I mean, my wife's family are there. I love the city. It's an amazing place. Why? So he said, well, we're having some issues with the guy that runs the race over there, the promoter. You know, he's, again, things that Bernie doesn't like. And again, this is all very public, that he wasn't paying suppliers and that there were some financial issues. And he was very publicly talking about how Bernie was shafting him in terms of the race fees going up, but it was a contract that had been signed. So Bernie said, would you consider going to Montreal to run the race? So I said, absolutely, I'd love to do it. Nothing in writing with Bernie. I got a handshake agreement with him, and I up sticks and moved here. And so that would have been 2016, the start of 2016. So I come to the race here as Bernie's guest in June 2016, and he shows me around, and he literally says to me, he's pointing at things and saying, that's not right, that's not right, that needs changing, that needs changing. And obviously, when we'd had the initial conversation, he said to me, look, you've been to every race. You know what's right and what's wrong. You know what promoters do right and what they do wrong. I've seen the way that you run the business. I know you can run a business. So the things all match together for you to be a perfect person. At the time, I said to him, yeah, okay, I haven't got the money to do this. And he said, well, we're going to pay for it all. We just want you to be the face of it. So I come June 2016, walk around the circuit, look at everything. July 2016 at the Italian GP is when it's announced that Liberty are buying Bernie out. So I all buying CVC out. So I instantly get on the phone to him and I say, how is this going to affect our deal? So he said, no problem. He said, his exact words, he said, Liberty don't know anything about Formula One and they're going to keep me on as CEO for 3 years. So my deal with you stands. So I said, okay, fine. So we continue through the rest of 2016. By this stage, I'm married now. My wife's pregnant. We're settled here in Montreal. We get through to January 2017. Liberty finally signed the check to buy Bernie out. And obviously, as we now know, they sacked him or they moved him to chairman emeritus. And I get in contact with him and he said, I'll write them a letter, which I've still got. I'll frame it. It'll be in my bathroom when I move someday. But he writes me a letter saying to Ross Brawn, saying, this is Matthew Carter. This is a guy I wanted to run the race in Montreal. Strongly suggest that you take a look at this. And I get a response back from Ross basically saying, look, we've got bigger issues than Montreal at the moment. At the time, Silverstone was rocky. Brazil was rocky. Germany was rocky. He just said, Montreal is the least of our worries. So we're going to stick with the status quo.
Oh, God.
So that's the reason I'm here. Long-winded answer to your question. I think that in terms of the spectacle of the sport, it is probably better now. I don't know whether that's because of Liberty or it's because of the way that the cars and the teams are. I think coronavirus obviously helped them in terms of them getting their budget cuts, the cost caps in, which whilst I've got my own views on that and the rights and the wrongs of it, the way it is structured at the moment is basically pointless. But if it is the structure that can lead to a better cost cap, then so be it. And by that, I mean, at Lotus, I dug the figures out a while ago, but at Lotus, I think let's say we were 120 turnover, and the budget cap's been set at 145. Mm. So we would have been under anyway, but it's been set at 145, and it excludes driver salaries, it excludes logistics, it excludes marketing, and I took pro rata those elements of our budget back in 2015, and if you add them into a Mercedes budget of, let's say, 300 million, it's still 300 million.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're 145 and you get Lewis's salary at 40 million, you're instantly into, you're just up to the 200. Then you've got the top five executives. So that'd be Toto and James Allison and those kind of people. There's a few more millions to add in there. Then you've got logistics. Back in the day, us at Lotus, we were 17 million a year in logistics. And we're nowhere near the size of Mercedes. So the fact that Liberty managed to get that through, albeit in a, that's for another discussion, with my feelings on that. The fact they've done that is good. And I think that will ultimately, and I think that's probably why Williams managed to sell for the price that they sold for, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because I think that and the signing of the Concorde Agreement at the same time, I think is really the reason that the guys jumped into Williams, because it suddenly starts to look like a bit less. And I don't think Bernie ever apologized for this. He was very much elitist. It was very much, if the small teams fail, then so
that's
be
their
it.
Problem. Well, I did some work with Max Chilton when he was driving at what was then Marussia, obviously became Manor, but he was very dismissive of them. I think he once referred to them as the gypsies of the grid.
Yeah.
He had no time for it. And you kind of get it. It was an old school way of doing it, but, it clearly worked. Talking of Williams, do you know these guys that have come in and rescued the team? No,
it came completely out of the blue. I actually got approached by someone who was potentially interested in looking at Williams. So I reached out to Claire and the people that were selling it just to get some more details at the start of the process, and it didn't come to fruition. But when these guys bought, I did a tiny bit of research, tried to have a look, but I can't see any. The only link I can see is that the chief legal officer was once the chief legal officer for Pirelli.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean,
it's a tenuous link. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the
Looking at the state of Formula One now, and if the right opportunity came about, would you ever consider going back either as a team principal role or running the business side of one of the teams? Would you ever consider that again?
Potentially, but it's very. Again, it's a question I've been asked a lot, and there's only 10 team principals, and of those 10, there's probably 7 or 8 that are set in stone, albeit changed recently, but, obviously Claire at Williams or the team principals was Frank, but still that's kind of set in stone. And so to go in a position that was, a few steps down would be a bit strange. I did go into So when I left Lotus, before I moved here and took Bernie up on his non-existent opportunity of running the Grand Prix in Montreal, I went and worked for Ron Dennis for a while. But that was him, and he's got a tech investment company. I went and worked for him, so based at his house. So that was kind of a six-month gig, during which time he and I spoke a lot about, you know, going back into Formula One and how it looked. And he kept telling me not to, that it was not the way to go. And then I worked for Stephen Fitzpatrick at Manor for about 2.5 weeks before I realised that the team was completely...
Was it not? It couldn't be saved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't need saving. It just needed, that's the best way to word this, it needed a slightly more realistic approach. In the way that, yeah, and it could have worked. And that's the reason I met with him a few times, and I sort of talked to him about what I thought. And I, at the time, so they picked up the Mercedes engine, if you remember, in 2016.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they had a Mercedes engine, they had a Williams gearbox and rear suspension. They had
a couple of really good drivers as well, actually, didn't they? If I remember,
Pascal Wehrlein, yeah, the Mercedes.
And Ocon, I think, came in as well, didn't he?
Ocon came in after my time, but at the time,
oh, right, okay, yeah, Wehrlein.
And they had the Indonesian kid.
Oh, Haryanto.
Yes, Rio. Hmm. So they had those two drivers. And as I say, Mercedes engine, you know, Williams rear end effectively. And I said to Stephen Fitzpatrick, and it was almost a Haas style approach. It was almost, you know, we could probably do this, but we need to go in very much with our eyes wide open, very much, you know, we only do maybe two updates through the whole of the season. And, you know, and he said, yes. And then when I got there, I realized that he had designs on being on the top step of the podium. Mm. And it was never going to happen.
Just a bit unrealistic, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of lasted about 2.5 weeks and then I left. And then a guy who used to work for me, a guy called Thomas Mayer, who used to work at Lotus as my COO, he went in and did the CEO job at Manor. And I told him from day one, they're not going to finish the season.
Shame, real shame. Now, listen, conscious of time, I've got a few more quick fire questions for you. First of all, who was your best mate in the paddock when you were in F1? Who did you enjoy hanging out with?
Oh, crikey. So it was actually a guy called Federico Gastaldi, who was, I think his title was deputy team principal at Lotus, but he'd been in Formula One for years and years and years. He was the promoter of the Argentinian Grand Prix, mm-hmm. knew everyone. When I first went to Lotus, he was the guy that... So it is a very glamorous lifestyle, don't get me wrong, but the way I was doing it, I would land at an airport, get off the plane, I'd have hundreds of emails to deal with. I'd be met by Federico and a driver. We'd get in a car, we'd go to a hotel. On the journey to the hotel, he'd tell me what happened in the last couple of days, where we were at, which sponsors were there, et cetera, et cetera. Stay in a hotel room, up the next morning, Federico and I, in a car, driven by the same driver that drove me, whether I was in Australia or Bahrain or Montreal. We'd go to the track, and as you guys know, you walk in through the paddock and it's exactly the same wherever you are because the team have gone in ahead. So I'd then go into our hospitality, be served coffee by the same waitress, eat the same food, then walk into the garage, which had been made to look exactly the same as the garage anywhere else around the world, go and sit on the pit wall and see 50 meters of racetrack, and then do it all in reverse. So it wasn't party, party, party. Yeah, Monaco was the only one where you do let your hair down ever so slightly because of the way you have the Friday break day.
Mm-hmm.
But so basically, I would say it would probably be Federico because he was the one that I spent all the time with and he had such great knowledge and knew all the characters in Formula One that he effectively walked me up and down that paddock on the first few times and introduced me to people that you wouldn't necessarily know, like the guy who runs Pirelli or, you know, the guy at the FIA who, you know, looks after the press conferences,
yeah.
Mathieu, who's not there anymore. But, he, you know, those kind of people that you need to know. So I would say him.
Yeah. What are you crap at?
DIY.
Same.
Any particularly bad experiences you can recall?
I put a shelf up for our son in our son's bedroom when he was a baby, and it was supposed to be a what they call it, a floating shelf IKEA.
We got a few of those off the wall.
I was getting so annoyed with it, and I eventually got it up, and my wife came in and tried to put some soft toys on it, and I said, whoa.
Far too heavy. Do not go there. No, I'm totally with you on the DIY.
Like, how much weight can it take? And I was like, no.
Don't nothing. Even breathe on it. What about, let's flip that around. What are you, outside of business, what are you good at? Have you got a hidden talent?
No, I don't think so, no. I enjoy playing golf, but I'm definitely not good at it. Nothing that immediately springs to mind.
Okay, so we have three final questions for you, which we ask of all of our guests, no matter who they are, and they all provide quite varied and interesting answers. Harry, do you want to kick off?
Yeah, absolutely. So Matthew, what's got you excited at the moment?
Formula E.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, come on. You've got to divulge that. Are you involved somehow, or are you just enjoying the sport?
potentially will be involved. But I honestly can't say too much about it. But I just think that if we get a bit more serious for a minute, I just think the way that the car industry is moving with everything that's going on and the way that manufacturers have to have an element of electric and hybrid within their range, it kind of makes sense. I think Alejandro did an amazing and a ballsy deal, you know, at the start there, where he signed, you know, he's got a 25-year exclusivity on single-seater, all-electric racing. And the fact that he's got that, I think, means that Formula One and Formula E at some point are going to have to, you know, there's not going to be space for both of them. This is my opinion. It's only my opinion. So again, bear in mind, Alejandro had a 25-year agreement. He's into year six now. All the manufacturers are jumping. There's more manufacturers in Formula E than there are in Formula One.
Yep.
Mercedes are in there now. You know, BMW, Porsche, Jaguar. And Liberty, which only happened recently. Liberty, it's a slightly different arm of Liberty, but it is Liberty nonetheless. And now the biggest shareholders in Formula E. So I think all these things lead to the fact that something could well happen. Now, you know, the quality of the racing, the way that things are set up, you know, there's lots of downsides to it at the moment. There's lots of things that aren't quite right. But the progression of electrification and the way that battery technology and range and power are all coming, then I think it's a matter of time before something happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't agree more. I'm a big advocate of Formula E. I've loved it ever since I first watched it, even though that first season, looking back at it now, you think, good God, how did anyone watch that? But you look at how far it's come in just, as you say, about to enter year six. Think of what the future holds for it. It's year very seven. Exciting.
Into year seven, aren't we now? Well, we will be. It is an interesting sport, and it's also from a brand perspective, from a sponsorship perspective, you know, everyone wants to be involved with it because it provides that sort of more purpose-driven sponsorship messaging. Second one for you, if not doing what you're doing, and I know you've got various business interests and still touch motorsport as well, but what would you be doing?
God.
This is always a tough one for people, always a tough one.
Because the weird thing is, and I really don't want to sound arrogant at all, but from a work point of view, I tend to do what I want to do anyway, and always really have done. So it's not as if I look at, I'd love to be a great sportsman in something, I don't know, whatever it may be, maybe a professional golfer or a professional soccer player, or I said soccer, I've been in Canada for too long. But yeah, something like that. But from a work point of view, no, I think... you know, my path has taken very many different turns, and you know, I'm in a pretty good place at the moment. I'm pretty happy.
Good. Not too pissed off with Bernie, or
no, not at all. Bernie is it wasn't his fault at all. It was a strange set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. Bernie did an awful lot to help. There's a lot of other things that happened at the team. You know, there were times when, you know, again, the two owners, and I really don't want to paint them in a bad stride, but there were occasions when, you know, payroll was due and I knew that we didn't have the money or it was due to come in a little bit later or whatever. And Bernie always pays, or FOM, always pay the teams on the last working day of the month, like religiously. So our cut of the prize fund was, let's say it was 10 million that we were getting every month. No, it wouldn't have been that. It would have been five because we had sponsorship money on top. So let's say it was 5 million at the end of every month. That effectively covered my payroll. And and our payroll was due on the 25th. And I'd made a commitment to the staff that, you know, I would do my absolute damnedest to make sure they got their money on time, because everyone's got mortgages, everyone's got commitments, whatever. Mm-hmm. So Bernie would pay us on the last working day. I'd have payroll on the 25th. So I went to Bernie a few times and said, can you pay me a few days early? And I remember him pulling me to one side and I said, I've never done this before, but I'm doing it.
Wow.
And he did it a couple of times.
Oh, fair play to him.
I've got a lot of time for him. I was talking to him the other day about something completely different. I do... I still get involved a little bit in trying to put some sponsorship deals together with Formula One. And he's, well, obviously he's got the best Rolodex that you could possibly imagine. And it's a very good name to drop into a, I mean, it does have bad connotations. Don't get me wrong, sometimes in certain elements, but it's certainly a good name to drop into a conversation.
Definitely. Final question for you then. What are you scared of?
What am I scared of? I should have read the notes before, Andrew, shouldn't I? I'm prepared to have an answer.
It's good to be on the spot.
What am I scared of? Honest, I mean, again, without getting too deep, everything that's happened in the last 6 months has really made me sort of step back and reflect and that's not to say I'm necessarily scared of it, but it does humble you a little bit and make you realise, you know, that we spent a lot of time living life without really paying attention to some of the small things. So I'm not necessarily scared of it, but what am I scared of? I don't know. Spiders.
Yeah.
There we go.
That's brilliant. No, thank you, Matthew. I think it's been really interesting talking to you. Like I said, I think there's a book in there somewhere that needs to come out. Happy to be executive producer on the film when that comes out.
Same.
It's a fascinating story, and it's nice to hear. Harry and I were talking before we came on with you about how you, with things like Netflix, you do see a little bit about team principals, and you get under the skin of, you know, Günther Steiner, and you hear him swearing and stuff, but you don't really get to know the individual or hear the stories behind being a team principal. So it's fascinating, I think, for people to hear that firsthand. So thank you for all of that, and hopefully we'll see you back in a paddock one of these days soon, and we must do more of this. But for now, Matthew Carter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials: Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and on Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile, interact with others, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.